Hello, good afternoon, and thank you for tuning in to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your host, Diana, here with you every Saturday to bring you the news and top stories from the Military Times, your independent news source about your military. Today, I would like to start with this top story, which provides the most current update at the time of this recording to events concerning U.S. and Venezuela relations. And it reads, How the U.S. Captured Venezuelan Leader Nicolas Maduro. After months of growing military pressure on Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, President Donald Trump ordered a brazen operation into the South American country to capture its leader and whisk him away to the United States, where his administration planned to put him on trial. In a Saturday morning interview on Fox and Friends Weekend, Trump laid out the details of the overnight strike, after which he said Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores, were flown by helicopter to a U.S. warship. Maduro was in a fortress, Trump says. Trump described Maduro as being, quote, highly guarded in a presidential palace that was like a fortress, although the Venezuelan leader was not able to get to a safe room. American forces were armed with massive blowtorches, which they would have used to cut through steel walls had Maduro locked himself in the room, Trump said. Quote, It had what they call a safety space, where it's solid steel all around, Trump said. He didn't get that space closed. He was trying to get into it, but he got bum-rushed right so fast that he didn't get into that. We were prepared. Part of that preparation, Trump said, included practicing maneuvers on a replica building. They actually built a house which was identical to the one they went into with all the same, all that steel all over the place, Trump said. We turned off all the lights. Trump said that the U.S. operation took place in darkness, although he did not detail how that happened. He said the U.S. turned off, quote, almost all of the lights in Caracas, the capital of Venezuela. This thing was so organized, he said, and they go into a dark space with machine guns facing them all over the place. At least 7 explosions were heard in Caracas. The attack lasted less than 30 minutes. Venezuelan Vice President Delcy Rodriguez, who under that country's law takes power, said some Venezuelan civilians and members of the military were killed. Trump says a couple of guys injured. Trump said a few U.S. members of the operation were injured, but he believed no one was killed. A couple of guys were hit, but they came back and they're supposed to be in pretty good shape, he said. The Republican president said the U.S. had lost no aircraft, but that a helicopter was, quote, hit pretty hard. We had to do it because it's a war, he added. The weather was a factor. The president also said U.S. forces held off on conducting the operation for days, waiting for cloud cover to pass because the weather has to be perfect. We waited 4 days, he said. We were going to do this 4 days ago, 3 days ago, 2 days ago, and then all of a sudden it opened up and we said, go. And I'll tell you, it was just amazing. Where is Maduro now? Trump said that Maduro and Flores were flown by helicopter to a U.S. warship and would go on to New York to face charges. The Justice Department released an indictment accusing the pair of having an alleged role in a narco-terrorism conspiracy. Months of escalating actions. The raid was a dramatic escalation from a series of strikes the U.S. military has carried out on what Trump has said were drug-carrying boats in the Caribbean Sea and Eastern Pacific Ocean since early September. There have been 35 known strikes that killed at least 115 people. On December 29th, Trump said the U.S. struck a facility where boats accused of carrying drugs, quote, load up. the CIA, was behind the drone strike at a docking area believed to have been used by Venezuelan drug cartels. It was the first known direct operation on Venezuelan soil since the U.S. began its strikes in September. I'm sure we will hear more as the news develops. Up next, a year of strikes. U.S. military operations surge under Trump. President Donald Trump has presided over a rapid surge of U.S. military activity abroad since returning to the Oval Office. In the first year of his second term, he has authorized a series of strikes ranging from the unprecedented use of bunker buster bombs against Iran's most fortified nuclear sites to a sustained counter-narcotics operation off the Venezuelan coast. Trump, who has labeled himself a, quote, peace president, frames the expansion of force as a strategy of peace through strength. At his inaugural ball in January, he declared, quote, we will measure our success not only by the battles we win, but also by the wars that we end, and perhaps most importantly, the wars we never get into. Trump added that his, quote, proudest legacy will be that of a peacemaker and unifier. Since taking office on January 20th, 2025, Trump has overseen at least 626 airstrikes, according to data compiled by the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project that was shared with Military Times. By comparison, his predecessor, former President Joe Biden, launched a total of 555 strikes in his entire four-year term. Here's where the U.S. military operated overseas in 2025. Somalia, February 1st and ongoing. The first major strike in the second Trump administration targeted the Islamic State in Somalia. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth said the strikes aimed to degrade ISIS's ability to plot and conduct terrorist attacks threatening U.S. citizens, our partners, and innocent civilians. The campaign has continued in the region, representing a sustained U.S. military presence against ISIS affiliates in East Africa. Iraq, March 13th. A U.S.-led coalition strike in Iraq's Anbar province killed ISIS's second-highest-ranking leader, Abdallah Maki Musli al-Rifai, and one other insurgent. Iraq's prime minister described al-Rifai as one of the most dangerous terrorists in Iraq and the world. Yemen, March 15th to May 6th. In mid-March, the Trump administration began an air campaign against Iran-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen. The strikes targeted command and control hubs, air defense systems, and facilities used for manufacturing and storing advanced weapons, according to the Pentagon. The offensive, which used JSSM long-range cruise missiles, JSOWs, and Tomahawk missiles, surpassed $1 billion in costs within its first month. The operation concluded on May 6th, following an Oman-brokered ceasefire with the Houthis. Iran, June 22nd. Operation Midnight Hammer deployed seven B-2 stealth bombers from Missouri's Whiteman Air Force Base to strike Iran's deeply buried nuclear facilities. The bombers dropped 30,000-pound GBU-57 massive ordnance penetrators on Fordo and Natanz, while a U.S. Navy submarine in the region launched more than a dozen Tomahawk cruise missiles at Isfahan. Trump, in a primetime address, declared the mission achieved, quote, total obliteration of Iran's enrichment capabilities, though Tehran disputed that assessment. The Pentagon estimates the military strikes likely set back Iran's nuclear program by up to 2 years. Caribbean Sea and Eastern Pacific Ocean, September 2nd and ongoing. Since September, the U.S. military has waged a sustained campaign of lethal maritime strikes in the Caribbean Sea and Eastern Pacific, part of what the Trump administration says is an attempt to dismantle powerful drug cartels and stop the flow of Venezuelan narcotics into the United States. Trump boasts that the deployment involves the largest armada ever assembled in the history of South America, and pledged it will only get bigger. At least 106 people have been killed at the time that this was written, in strikes on alleged drug-carrying vessels. Syria, December 19th. Operation Hawkeye Strike was launched by Trump to avenge the deaths of two U.S. soldiers, Sergeant William Nathaniel Howard and Sergeant Edgar Brian Torres Tovar, and a civilian U.S. interpreter, Ayad Mansour Sakat, killed in a terrorist attack in Syria. American fighter jets, attack helicopters, and artillery struck more than 70 suspected ISIS targets across central Syria, according to CENTCOM. The operation was named in honor of the fallen soldiers from Iowa, the Hawkeye State. Nigeria, December 25th. On Christmas Day, Trump announced the U.S. carried out airstrikes against ISIS in Nigeria, Africa's most populous country. The president said he acted to protect Christians who he asserts are being, quote, mass slaughtered by, quote, radical Islamists, and chose the date for symbolic reasons. They were going to do it earlier, Trump said in an interview, and I said, nope, let's give a Christmas present. The operation involved more than a dozen Tomahawk cruise missiles launched from a Navy ship in the Gulf of Guinea and was coordinated with the Nigerian military. Venezuela, December and ongoing. The CIA reportedly carried out a drone strike on a facility in Venezuela, the first known U.S. attack inside the country since the Trump administration intensified its pressure campaign against the government of Nicolas Maduro. The strike targeted a dock along Venezuela's coast that officials said was being used by the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua to store narcotics and potentially prepare them for shipment, according to CNN. All right, now that we're caught up on military actions abroad, let's go a little closer to home. Trump says he's dropping push for National Guard in L.A. and other cities. President Donald Trump said he's dropping, for now, his push to deploy National Guard troops in Chicago, Los Angeles, and Portland, Oregon, a move that comes after legal roadblocks held up the effort. We will come back, perhaps in a much different and stronger form, when crime begins to soar again. Only a question of time, he said in a social media post Wednesday. Governors typically control states' National Guardsmen, and Trump had deployed troops to all three cities against the wishes of state and local Democratic leaders. He said it was necessary as part of a broader crackdown on immigration, crime, and protests. The president has made a crackdown on crime in cities a centerpiece of his second term, and has toyed with the idea of invoking the Insurrection Act to stop his opponents from using the courts to block his plans. He has said he sees his tough-on-crime approach as a winning political issue ahead of next year's midterm elections. Troops had already left Los Angeles after the president deployed them earlier this year as part of a broader crackdown on crime and immigration. In his post, Trump said the troops' presence was responsible for a drop in crime in the three cities, though they were never on the streets in Chicago and Portland as legal challenges played out. When the Chicago deployment was challenged in court, a Justice Department lawyer said the Guard's mission would be to protect federal properties and government agents in the field, not, quote, solving all of crime in Chicago. Portland Mayor Keith Wilson's office in a statement said the city's reduction in crime was due to the efforts of local police and public safety programs. Chicago officials echoed the sentiment, saying in release Tuesday that the city had 416 homicides in 2025, the fewest since 2014. Trump's push to deploy the troops in Democrat-led cities has been met with legal challenges at nearly every turn. Governors react. The Supreme Court in December refused to allow the Trump administration to deploy National Guard troops in the Chicago area. The order was not a final ruling, but was a significant and rare setback by the High Court for the president's efforts. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker wrote on X Wednesday that Trump, quote, lost in court when Illinois stood up against his attempt to militarize American cities with the National Guard. Now, Trump is forced to stand down. Hundreds of troops from California and Oregon were deployed to Portland, but a federal judge barred them from going on the streets. A judge permanently blocked the deployment of National Guard troops there in November after a 3-day trial. Oregon Governor Tina Kotek said in a statement Wednesday that her office had not yet received official notification that the remaining federalized Oregon National Guard troops can return home. They were never lawfully deployed to Portland, and there was no need for their presence. If President Donald Trump is finally chosen to follow court orders and demobilize our troops, that's a big win for Oregonians and for the rule of law. Trump's decision to federalize National Guard troops began in Los Angeles in June when protesters took to the streets in response to a blitz of immigration arrests in the area. He deployed about 4,000 troops and 700 Marines to guard federal buildings and later to protect federal agents as they carried out immigration arrests. The number of troops slowly dwindled until just several hundred were left. They were removed from the streets by December 15th after a lower court ruling that also ordered control to be returned to Governor Gavin Newsom. But an appeals court had paused the second part of the order, meaning control remained with Trump. In a Tuesday court filing, the Trump administration said it was no longer seeking a pause in that part of the order. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit on Wednesday ordered the Trump administration to return control of the National Guard to Newsom. About time Trump admitted defeat, Newsom said in a social media post. We've said it from day one. The federal takeover of California's National Guard is illegal. Troops will remain on the ground in several other cities. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit in December paused a lower court ruling that had called for an end to the deployment of National Guard troops in Washington, D.C., where they've been deployed since August after Trump declared a, quote, crime emergency. Trump also ordered the deployment of the Tennessee National Guard to Memphis in September as part of a larger federal task force to combat crime, a move supported by the state's Republican Governor Bill Lee and senators. A Tennessee judge blocked the use of the Guard, siding with Democratic state and local officials who sued. However, the judge stayed the decision to block the Guard as the state appeals, allowing the deployment to continue. In New Orleans, about 350 National Guard troops deployed by Trump arrived in the city's historic French Quarter on Tuesday and are set to stay through Mardi Gras to help with safety. The state's Republican governor and the city's Democratic mayor support the deployment. All right, we're going to move on to some news concerning our veterans. Court upholds order requiring the VA to build housing for veterans in L.A. A federal appeals court this week upheld a federal district court ruling ordering the Department of Veterans Affairs to dramatically expand housing for unhoused disabled veterans on its West Los Angeles campus. In a decision filed December 23rd, a 3-judge panel of the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed that the VA violated the Rehabilitation Act by failing to provide supportive housing for unhoused veterans with serious mental illness or traumatic brain injuries, according to documents in the case of Powers versus McDonough. This violation, in turn, meant veterans were denied meaningful access to critical health care services, the judges ruled. The class action lawsuit was brought by unhoused veterans and advocacy groups who argued that decades of land use agreements with private entities diverted the sprawling West Los Angeles VA campus from its intended purpose of housing and caring for disabled veterans. The United States Department of Veterans Affairs mission is to fulfill President Lincoln's promise to care for those who have served in our nation's military and for their families, caregivers, and survivors, Circuit Judge Anna De Alba stated in the court documents, citing VA's stated goal. This class action lawsuit and its numerous appeals demonstrates just how far the VA has strayed from its mission, De Alba continued. There are now scores of unhoused veterans trying to survive in and around the greater Los Angeles area, despite the acres of land deeded to the VA for their care. Rather than use the West Los Angeles VA grounds as President Lincoln intended, the VA has leased the land to third-party commercial interests that do little to benefit the veterans. The panel upheld the district court's findings that the VA's lack of adequate housing placed veterans at serious risk of institutionalization, violating the Supreme Court's Olmstead decision. It also ruled that the VA's practice of contracting with housing developers who impose income limits that count veterans' disability benefits as income was discriminatory under the Rehabilitation Act. The courts also affirmed the district court's authority to order sweeping relief to remedy those violations, including potentially requiring the VA to construct 1,800 permanent supportive housing units and 750 temporary units on the campus. The panel said the district court did not abuse its discretion in imposing those requirements as relief for discrimination. However, the appeals court reversed the district court's ruling that an 1888 deed created the campus established a judicially enforceable charitable trust obligating the VA to manage the land exclusively for veterans' housing. Because that charitable trust claim was the sole basis for voiding a lease with the University of California, Los Angeles, the panel dismissed UCLA's appeal as moot and vacated injunctions affecting UCLA's lease and services, the opinion said. The panel also vacated portions of the district court's judgment voiding leases with Brentwood School, an independent day school, and Bridgeland Resources, an oil and gas company, which relied on the charitable trust theory. Still, the court separately held that Brentwood's lease and Bridgeland's revocable license violated the West Los Angeles Leasing Act and the Administrative Procedure Act because they did not principally benefit veterans. The court ruled that the district court went too far in barring the VA from renegotiating those unlawful agreements, saying that aspect of the injunction exceeded what was necessary to remedy the violations. The case will now be returned to the district court to enter a revised judgment consistent with the decision of the appeals court. Okay, moving on to topics of military culture and service members. This article reads, "Parachutist at Armed Forces Bowl gets caught in wire, falls into crowd." A member of a veteran parachuting group who is descending onto the field for the annual Armed Forces Bowl college football game Friday appeared to get tangled in a wire before plummeting into the crowd, according to multiple reports. The parachutist, who belonged to the all-veteran group parachuting team, according to the Houston Chronicle, was gliding into the Texas State versus Rice game at Ammon G. Carter Stadium in Fort Worth, Texas, when the mishap occurred. The parachutist was one of several that jumped out of a plane above the field before the noon kickoff. The all-veteran group consists of active-duty service members and veterans who conduct parachute demonstrations to pay tribute to service members and raise money for nonprofit organizations. After the first parachutist made it onto the field safely, the Houston Chronicle reported, video shared on social media showed the second parachutist carrying the U.S. Navy flag briefly getting caught in what appeared to be a wire above the field before falling into the crowd. Three of the five parachutists landed safely, with another parachutist landing outside the stadium, according to Kef Sardello of the San Antonio Express News. The media director for the bowl game, Drew Harris, told the Houston Chronicle that the individual seen falling in the video was able to walk off the field under their own power. He also told the publication that no one in the stands was injured. The parachutist's name and information has not been released. And finally, up next, death of airmen caused by multiple points of failure, report finds. A U.S. Air Force special investigation found that a lack of following proper maintenance procedures and supervision led to the death of an Alaskan airman last year. In a 32-page report, the Air Force Aircraft Accident Investigation Board released its findings on the incident Monday, detailing the several human factors that contributed to the airman's death at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, Alaska. On March 15, 2024, Staff Sergeant Charles Crumlett, assigned to the 90th Fighter Generation Squadron, died in a workplace accident while working on an F-22 Raptor. Crumlett was the weapons load crew chief and had been stationed at the Alaskan base since February 2024, just 1 month before the accident. Crumlett, who's 25, enlisted in 2016 before graduating a year later as a weapons load crew member. The report, dated November 6th, states that Crumlett had prior experience maintaining the A-10 and F-15 aircrafts, but had only completed academic training on the F-22A. He was working with a team to learn the hands-on portion, the report says. The maintenance team was performing an adjustment to restraint fitting on the aircraft's right configurable rail launcher when Crumlett suffered a fatal head injury by the CRL's retraction, a memo on the investigation's release states. There is no line of sight between the cockpit ladder and the right side weapons bay, and the maintenance team chief retracted the CRL when all personnel were not clear, the report states. The investigation board found that the mishap was caused by a failure to follow prescribed procedures for service of the CRL and a failure to maintain supervisory direction and awareness. Investigators discovered that performing multiple tasks simultaneously, a proficiency level challenge, and a false sense of security by some team members also contributed to the death. The team multitasking resulted in task confusion and a lack of coordination, the investigators wrote in the report. The proficiency level challenge is attributed to an infrequency of the job performed, and the false sense of security is linked to an incorrect belief on the scope of functions of the safe switch for the side weapons bay. It seems widely believed that the safe switch inactivates the operation of both the bay doors as well as the CRL itself when it specifically only secures the doors, the investigators wrote. This could engender an inaccurate sense of security in a maintainer and prompt them to take an unwarranted risk. Additionally, there was no clear guidance on which maintenance member was leading the task, creating more confusion. The team members were forced to rely on nonverbal communication due to an enclosed workspace that had an auxiliary power unit in use, prompting the need for double hearing protection, the report found. An airman gave a thumbs up to team members to signal that he would retract the CRL, which was misinterpreted by fellow team members as all clear. This led to Crumlett's upper torso being inside the right side weapons bay when the retraction was commanded, causing the immediate fatal head trauma. Now I hate to end on that note, but that's all the time we have for today's news from the Military Times. Thank you once again for listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your host, Diana, signing out.